Hey everybody, welcome to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm joined today for a discussion of Side by Side by Keanu Reeves.
What?
I'm sorry, that's what I call JB. I've always called him Keanu Reeves.
And you know, when no one else is available to do the podcast, we just walk to the old man's house and poke him with sticks, and we wake him up, and we fill him up with Monster Energy drink, and he babbles on and on about movies for 56 minutes.
Yay! You can find our website at fthismovie.net. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fthismovie. Find us in the iTunes store by searching F This Movie. Find us through DVD Verdict at dvdverdictpresents.com and click on the Movie Podcast tab. And while you're there, click on one of the tens of thousands of DVD and Blu-ray reviews and buy something through the Amazon links. And you can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com.
And right now we're under your bed.
We're going to be talking about Side by Side, which
it's
is a new documentary. Well, listen, they haven't had time to clean. Labor Day.
They had to go to a carnival.
It's a new, carnivals are the best. It's a new documentary produced by and narrated by and hosted by.
Do we want to start with that?
Keanu Reeves. Well, we're going to come back around to it. I'm just saying.
Okay. I found Keanu's participation to be odd.
Odd is a good word.
Oddly troubling.
A lot of you guys probably haven't seen it. It's in limited release right now, but it is available via video on demand. The movie is about digital filmmaking versus sort of traditional 35mm filmmaking. So we're going to be talking about that. So even if you haven't seen the movie, stick around for our insightful thoughts on the future of filmmaking.
Warning, it's going to be esoterica fest. This film, this documentary defines the esoteric.
But
it's going to be at the Gene Siskel Film Center. Oh. I believe September 15th, 16th, 17th, okay. If you live in the Chicagoland area.
Or watch it in your living room. Either way.
Oddly enough, that's an issue that the film addresses.
Sure is. It sure is.
I saw what you did there.
But we're going to be talking about that in a minute. First, I have to ask, Jay Bones, have you seen anything good lately?
Yes.
Great.
We got to see The Intouchables, which I had sort of avoided all summer.
Yeah, me too.
After reading an article about it on Slate, where there was a minor controversy suggesting the film was racist because of its casting. And it looked interesting, but again, it looked like work. It looked like a school assignment. And finally, as I mentioned last week, there was nothing left to see. So we went, and it was good.
Okay.
Not great.
Okay.
It avoids a lot of the pitfalls of similar feel-good infirmary it's not a documentary, it's a fiction film about someone who's has a handicap.
Right.
And in some way so cleverly negotiates that it's not till the end that you realize just how conventional and cliched and trite it is. It was almost as if a schizophrenic sensibility was behind it, who said, in each individual scene, we'll avoid the cliché by doing this. And when all the scenes are added together, it'll be one big cliché.
I'm a bad moviegoer because I love movies. I love all kinds of movies, but there are certain kinds of movies where I see the trailer and I think, I'm probably not going to see that. I try not to be closed-minded in that way, but The Intouchables was a movie where I thought, I'm probably okay.
I would recommend it for the performances, although, again, the poster features both main characters sort of smiling at the camera in this odd way. The performances were very good. I saw it at this theater that's sort of old and broken down, and the audience was full of older people who don't get out much, and people were arriving 25 minutes late.
I saw a movie at that same theater recently and had the same experience. People were arriving halfway through the movie.
That's a relatively affluent suburb. So I began, you know, to excessively ruminate on the phenomenon and just think, these are rich people who make their own rules. But it just seems like if it's a French film that's subtitled, the first 20 minutes is going to contain double.
That's when you learn French.
Double the exposition.
Nobody came in and said, like, hey, start it again.
No. When the film was over, the audience applauded.
Really?
And I really got the feeling I think I've made this joke before.
That what the, was that the sound of applause, or was that the sound of them patting themselves on the back?
Exactly. We just watched a movie in French. Hooray for us!
Aren't we terrific?
That's the way I interpreted it. It's not a bad film. It's not a hypocritical, ugly film that's lying to us and deceiving us about the world. I just thought, and we've mentioned things like this before, that the parts of it that were good were so good it gave you hope that it would be that much better.
Yeah. I saw two movies that I'll talk about quickly. I rewatched a bunch of, like, Tony Scott movies because he died and we didn't talk about that on last week's show. So I rewatched a bunch of those, and my opinion on them has not really changed. I keep trying to give Man on Fire a chance. Have you seen Man on Fire?
No.
Okay. I keep trying to give it a chance because everybody swears, oh, it's great, it's great. I'm with it for about 45 minutes to an hour, but that movie's 2.5 hours long. And it
I've read a lot about it, and not to get all, Patrick just mentioned, patting yourself or other people on the back. If you haven't read Patrick's review of True Romance, you need to, because it was something really special.
Oh, well, that's nice of you to say.
There was a paragraph in it that really got to me.
The part where I described the plot?
No.
So I watched that, but I will talk about, I finally got to see The 5-Year Engagement, which came out earlier this year.
Oh, yeah.
At a time where I wasn't able to see it. I think that was around when our daughter was born, and so obviously some stuff fell through the cracks. I actually really wanted to see that movie. I liked the trailer, and it was the people that did Forgetting Sarah Marshall, and I'm a big fan of Forgetting Sarah Marshall. I think that movie's really great. So I really had high hopes, and I was very disappointed. It's got a lot of problems.
Well, I was just going to say, I'm not as big a fan of Forgetting Sarah Marshall as you, and I particularly hated the trailer for the 5-Year Engagement.
Okay, interesting. I like a lot of the actors in the movie, and so that's sort of what carried me through it, but it felt like... And a lot of the Judd Apatow-produced comedies have this problem. They're all 40 minutes too long. But this movie in particular, not only it's over 2 hours, so it's criminally overlong, but it also felt like there were all these scenes that seemed like you were watching the deleted scenes, like you had selected play all.
And you mentioned this phenomenon before, that when you go see Bridesmaids, it seems like one film, and then there's a scene that looks like a big fat note from Judd Apatow.
Yeah.
If you do this, the movie will make more money.
5-Year Engagement, more than I think any of his movies, just felt like all these weird deleted scenes put together where not even like fourth tier characters have a 10-minute long scene with just each other. Like, why is this here? This doesn't advance the story. This doesn't inform anything. That was a big letdown. And then I also watched via video on demand a movie called VHS, which is a new horror anthology that's been making the rounds at festivals. I wish I could remember more of the directors involved.
I heard several people discussing this at a barbecue I attended last night.
Ty West is one of the directors who contributed a piece, who did The Innkeepers earlier this year, which I really loved. Like so many anthologies.
Is VHS better than Chillerama?
Oh, yes. Okay. Definitely better than Chillerama.
Because you did not recommend that. Your review made me want to see it. I have not seen it.
I believe it's on Netflix Instant.
Oh, boy.
You can definitely check it out.
Even if I don't watch it, I'll be recommending it next week at Netflix, this movie.
VHS takes a thing that I like, which is the horror anthology, and combines it with something I don't like, which is the found footage horror movie.
Oh,
and that's what it is. It's six different little found footage movies.
What hath
strung together with
Blair Witch Rock,
with this terrible sort of wraparound thing that just barely ties the things together. I don't know. It's been so long since we had a really good anthology. I mean, Trick or Treat is pretty great.
No, it's terrific.
And before Trick or Treat, it's what? Creepshow?
I was going to say Dead of Night, but I'm thinking maybe No One.
And Dead of Night is older, isn't
it? Oh,
that
was my joke.
Okay,
and,
I'm sorry.
And I'm wondering how many people listening to this podcast are aware of Dead of Night, because Dead of Night's terrific.
Yeah.
You got to be patient. Have you seen it?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so happy.
Yeah. So many anthologies are so bad and it's so upsetting, where it's like, boy, if one story works, all of a sudden you're like, well, that wasn't bad, but no, that's 2/3 of a movie that's bad. VHS has a lot of neat ideas. The style certainly makes it feel And this speaks to what we're going to be talking about, where it feels a little scarier because of this format, that it's this weird choppy VHS where it feels quote unquote real, you know, and it kind of plays around with a lot of that stuff. The problem, I think the biggest problem with VHS is that the very best segment is first, and it's pretty great. And it's from one of the guys who did The Signal, which is a movie I've talked about before. It's really good. And then the movie's kind of all downhill after that, and but that again, rarely happens.
Who working on something like that?
Says, let's put this up front.
You got to put the strongest one last. Man.
You would think, yeah.
That's or why George least, Miller brings up the rear in Twilight Zone, the movie. That's something.
Yeah. Well, you need something good at the beginning to hook.
Yes.
And then the showstopper at the end. And Twilight Zone, the movie, does not do that. Twilight Zone, the movie, actually gets it doesn't get better as it goes along because Spielberg is second.
Later. We're going to do a whole podcast on Twilight Zone, the movie.
All right.
I have many things to say about that.
They don't all involve a helicopter accident, do they? Because that's the part of the movie that interests me the least.
We could talk about that. I used to show the final sequence in film study class for a really long time as sort of an editing demo.
The George Miller one?
Yeah, watching it frame by frame.
Yeah.
And my classes and I discovered all sorts of crazy shit going on in that. So later. I don't know, does that qualify as a horror film?
Probably not, but maybe we'll do it in September as like a run-up.
At some point, we are going to talk about Twilight Zone, the movie.
Yeah, yeah. Not Twilight Zone, the show. Anyway, VHS is available via video on demand. If you are a horror movie fan, I say check it out. Honestly, there are things to like in it. I would say it's trying to do something a little different, but actually it isn't. It's just trying to do two overdone things together for the first time. So that's novel, right? Anyway, check it out. It's a mixed bag.
It's so parasitic how something will come out in the horror genre because there are so few good ideas.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking Halloween. And then we get 600 Halloween ripoffs.
Yeah.
And then Blair Witch comes out. And that's even easier to rip off because that disguises all of your filmmaking mistakes. Oh, no, you know, it's the kids. It's the kids in the movie. In our version, it's different because they're making flip books. They make a flip book, and the flip book becomes animated. It becomes horrified by ghosts. It's a little different spin. So if the animation looks crude, hey, it's high school students drawing a flip book during study hall.
Horror movies are in a bad place right now, and I say that, you know.
But right now.
We've actually had a few good ones in the last 2 years.
Yes.
You've gone on about The Woman in Black. I don't mean that in a bad way.
You just won't
shut up about it.
The Woman in Black.
I love The Woman. We both love Cabin in the Woods.
Yeah.
I liked The Innkeepers. At the same time, there are all these horror movies that a lot of them are playing right now, and I'm pretty good at knowing, like, what's in theaters right now. And I'm pretty good with titles. Like, I can keep all that shit straight in my head.
There's three that just came out.
I don't
out.
Know what they are. They're all the same movie, right?
The Apparition.
The Possession.
Deceivement.
Yeah.
The...
They're all the same. And they all... none of them interest me in the slightest. I'm so sick of demonic possession movies, ghost movies.
They're all from a new studio. The Secret to Success is an article... and a pretentious-sounding noun for something that's a verb.
And this movie, The Apparition...
The Deceiving, The Reckoning, The Apparition.
The Apparition is one, because that's the one with the girl from Twilight.
The Awakening is another one.
Okay.
And I thought that was hilarious. Get ready for an English teacher joke.
Oh, that's in super limited release, right?
Right.
Yeah, that's playing by us now.
When I first saw the little poster on the...
You foolishly assumed
on
that
Flickster,
it was... Yeah.
It was an adaptation of a very famous Kate Chopin novella.
Nope.
Perfect for Halloween. She wants to have an affair because her husband no longer pays any attention
Liberation.
To her.
Liberation! So The Apparition is marketed with the Ashley Green from Twilight on a poster, and there's like some hands covering her up, and the text on the poster says, like, once you believe, you die, or something.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I find out later from reading reviews, and that movie's gotten some of the worst reviews of the year, that actually... is never in the movie. Like, there's no aspect of the movie that's like, once you believe in something, you die. But even before I knew that, I objected to the poster because I thought, once you believe, you die, that seems like an easy thing to get around. I just won't believe.
And it's heavy in the trailer. So once again, we brought this up last week. This is the marketing department saying, no, it's not this.
Right.
But in this case, they're disagreeing with the plot of the film. No, junior high kids. Oh, if you believe you're dead,
that just seems like the easiest thing to fix. No problem. I don't believe in ghosts. I would think it would be scarier if you don't believe you die.
Maybe it's targeted to a youth audience who are not yet able to talk themselves out of things.
The first movie that's so niche marketed.
This is for very insecure teenagers.
They're going to love it. Also, that movie is like 75 minutes long.
This is a film for kids with low self-esteem.
All right, let's talk about Side by Side.
This is a strange film, and I recommend it because, again, I did it video on demand or whatever it's called and paid an extra buck to see it in HD, which actually paid off because the film clips that they use are from films you're familiar with, and clearly they took pains because they just look amazing. And in some cases, less than amazing, because the point that they're making is at certain stages, things didn't look good. But the film begins with some of Edward Muybridge's motion studies of the horse at full gallop and stuff. And I'm sorry. I mean, I've been teaching film study for so long. I'm sitting there during the first minute. You got me. Later, I thought it sort of dragged.
Yes. When it started, and it started with that stuff, and there's Trip to the Moon, and a little brief history, and it's showing all these clips from a lot of contemporary movies, and I turn to my wife, who teaches a film class at her high school, not the same class that you teach, but I said, hey, this might be something that you can use, but about halfway through, it turns into, here's the history of digital cameras, and here's the evolution of the technology, which is sort of interesting, but not what I thought the movie was trying to say.
I said exactly the same thing, that the first half hour would be really interesting for my kids and might spark some discussion, but I give the film credit for bringing up a whole bunch of different issues. But ultimately, I thought by the end, it sort of had gotten lost in a maze and didn't know how to get out.
Well, part of that, I think, is inherent to the conversation because the movie isn't necessarily trying to answer anything. It's just saying, it's asking a bunch of famous filmmakers, and that was the part that excited me, was that it's a bunch of talking heads of David Lynch and Martin Scorsese and James Cameron and Christopher Nolan.
None of these people disappoint.
No.
Nolan comes across as intellectual.
And he has one of my favorite metaphors in the movie, which we'll get to.
And Cameron just comes across as the most insufferable prick ever in God's green earth.
Yeah.
I think I overheard this last night at this barbecue, so I think I'm stealing Patrick's joke. How would you characterize Scorsese's participation in his answer to nearly every question?
Well, I was telling Mike about the documentary, and we're talking about, you know, Christopher Nolan is very pro-film, and Cameron is pro-digital, and he said, well, where does Scorsese come down? And my answer was, Scorsese seems to be like, whatever, this is where things are going, you know? It's like,
what I'm really excited about is that they still let me make pictures, right? And the key is that we're making pictures. And I still think it's so wonderful that he uses that phrase, because I think that's the phrase we should use. But
Joe Dante says that, too.
You really expected him to have more specific things to say, because he is so insightful.
Yeah.
And I thought he came across as he's taking a step back and waiting, and maybe that's just because the body of his work is established.
Yeah.
I thought Lynch came across as a crazy old man.
Okay. That's kind of what he is, right?
Yeah.
And Danny Boyle is in there, and I thought he said something sort of interesting at the end, where he says, like, if you're not willing to come along, that's okay, but prepare to be left behind, basically, is what he said. So the movie's not really looking to answer anything. It's just getting a bunch of different opinions. And that's not the problem with the movie, because I think the problem with the movie is that it's trying to focus on too many different things. But ultimately, that is the answer, is it's just opinion. It's what do you like? And some people like this, and some people like this. And some people will swear this is the only way to do it, and other people will say, you're crazy, this is the way to do it.
I am not a purist. I'm not going to sit here and insist 35 millimeter only, although I love the people behind the Northwest Chicago Film Society who are so intent on saving the art form on celluloid, that to them, that's the art of it, that it's on celluloid. And again, I've said this before, they remind me of the characters in Fahrenheit 451 who memorize books because they want to keep something going. I've seen film look awful. I'm remembering many years ago there was a screening of Horror of Dracula at the Music Box, until recently the Happiest Place on Earth. And Christopher Lee was in town. He was on the jury for the Chicago Film Festival. And so Christopher Lee is going to be at the Music Box introducing a screening of Horror of Dracula. Now, how on earth could you miss that?
Yeah, right.
So I went. And he began to tell stories of making these films and his friendship with...
Terrence Fisher? Peter Cushing?
Peter Cushing.
Got it.
And I sat there, and I'm sure I wasn't alone. I was like, you don't have to show them. I just want to hear him talk for an hour and a half.
Yeah.
But he had other places to go. I think he spoke for a half an hour. It was really, really like one of the 10 greatest film-going experiences. And the lights went down, and they proceeded to show the worst-looking print of Horror of Dracula I've ever seen. So I've been there. I've seen really bad-looking digital stuff projected in a theater. So I'm not going to sit here and say, you know, vinyl, LP records have a warmth that digital, although I know that those people exist too.
Yeah.
When my son found out that we were doing a podcast on Side by Side, he said something on the order of, the title of that film is very appropriate because it just comes down.
Right. Right.
To two sides that'll never agree.
Except that one side is going to go away. Because
the
new generation doesn't care. They have no affinity for film whatsoever, and they're happy to have digital. And the movie kind of gets into that with people watching movies on their iPhones, and Greta Gerwig at one point even talks about, because she made all these little mumblecore movies that are all shot on, you know, home video, basically, and she says, I think maybe when she made Arthur, I don't know if that's the movie she's talking about specifically, but she said the first time she was on a set where they were using film, it made her very nervous to hear the sound of the film going through the camera because she realized she couldn't screw up.
And she said, it's the sound of money going through the camera, which I thought was a great quote.
Right. There's a lot of those in the movie. I wish I was writing a bunch of them down because a lot of people say some really interesting, insightful things.
And that's another reason to see it.
Yeah.
And you should see it. However,
I
was so looking forward to something that was 98 minutes.
Yeah.
And I don't think I ever paused it. It did not feel like 98 minutes to me.
Again, that whole middle section just gets bogged down in, and then they had this camera, and then this camera, and this is how this works. And I appreciate it. Again, Keanu Reeves' participation is very odd. It's really, that's what Keanu Reeves is doing? He's making this documentary about these two kinds of film. I appreciate that he sort of wanted to do it, that he has a curiosity about it. In his interviews, I feel like he's listening, and I like some of the responses
he has
to people.
He does have a rapport.
Yeah.
Especially with the
Wachowskis.
Right, because he's made those films.
Oh, remind me to come back to them. They said something very disturbing to me.
But there's such a weirdness because here's the problem I had. He produced the film. So he's running resistance with the studio, or he put up money, or he's going to be one of the planners. But he didn't write and direct the film.
Right.
He is on screen doing interviews,
right,
and he does narrate.
Right.
And this led to a hall of mirrors where the narration was well written, but not well delivered.
Yeah, he should not have narrated.
So at the beginning, we're seeing all these compelling images and being bombarded with these ideas, but it's like, who's that voice? Oh, it's Keanu. That doesn't work at all.
Yeah.
And then during the interviews, I then wonder if he wrote the questions. Because a lot of it seems very banterish.
Yeah.
At one point, is it Cameron who says, you've been on a film set?
Yeah.
Which, that was pretty funny. But it creates this weird thing where I don't know what his participation really was.
Sure.
It certainly comes across, if the minute the film is over, you shut it off and don't see the first credit that comes up. It certainly comes across as, this is Keanu's project that he did one summer.
And that's sort of, it's not necessarily being marketed that way, but as it's being talked about, it's sort of, you know, that new Keanu Reeves documentary. But you're right, he didn't write or direct it, but he's sort of the face of it.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. But again, I liked him in the question and answer, you know, in the interviews.
I liked him better in those than I've liked him in a lot of films recently.
And he seems to have like a genuine sort of curiosity, and
it was filmed over a number of years, so you get to play the game where he's looking
different facial hair. It's all over the place.
He's got very good taste in shoes. What do the Wachowski brothers say that you found so interesting?
Well, it comes later in the movie when they start to talk more about digital. They're talking about film as a communal experience, and so they're Keanu Reeves is saying like, "Oh, but you'll lose this idea of everybody sitting together, an audience watching a movie together, if everybody's just watching on their computers and on their phones and everything." And you know, the Wachowskis who are out there, and certainly I guess on the cutting edge technologically, and certainly don't seem tied down to nostalgia or things of the past. Say something, and I don't remember which one it was, if it was Andy or Lana.
This part struck me too.
But, oh shit, what's the exact quote? That, like, watching things virtually is more communal or something to that effect? Like, that's just bullshit. You can't just say that. That if we're all alone on our computers, somehow that's more of a community experience. Because you're, like, talking about it.
That was my assumption, that they said
over Twitter or social media or whatever.
And the minute they said that, I thought it was thought-provoking, because A, I don't think when you watch a movie, you should be doing all that.
No.
But B, when they first brought that up, the first thing I thought of was the first annual F This Movie Film Festival.
Yes.
Alive on the Twitter, where we sort of excuse ourselves because our assumption is we've certainly seen these films before,
right,
and we're assuming most of the
right
people joining us have too, but they have a point.
How do they have a point?
I'm not 16.
Right.
And the way a 16-year-old defines watching a movie might now have nothing to do with the experience that I give that name to.
I guess, but I just don't think you can make the argument that all of us sitting alone on our computers tweeting about it is more communal than all of us sitting in a theater together.
I'd like to think that.
I'm not saying that there's nothing to, but again, we did that Twitter thing because we couldn't all get together. That was the idea, that we would love to all be together. That's the way to watch a movie, but if you can't.
I would love to think that sitting down in this church-like space with a lot of strangers and enjoying something together says something about our humanity, something very positive about our humanity. And I've had amazing experience in crowded theaters watching things together. But the other side of that is, and I think you can relate to this, of late, my favorite movie-going experience is going so early in the morning that there's no one else there.
Sure.
And paying extra to see The Dark Knight Returns,
right,
so I don't have to put up with
right
a crowd.
Right.
So, again, this is an entire podcast of me on the fence, and I don't like being on the fence because I'm a substantial man and sitting on the fence hurts.
But think about something like how much fun it is when we go to the 24-hour horror festival in October, and how much fun that is with that crowd who's all, you know, enthusiastic and applauding at the names. And
you are now proving your own point from earlier about it's just one side versus
absolutely
the other.
Absolutely.
Because think about how much fun okay it is to go to the 24-hour horror marathon, and there's so many aspects of it we like, and then think about those 4 years in a row
sure
that those drunken guys
right
who did not know what comedy was, but who thought they were funny,
yeah,
sat behind us.
Yeah. See, the problem is, and this is what we all do as movie fans, and I'm assuming anybody who's listening to a movie podcast is a movie fan, like more than just, yeah, I'll watch a movie if it's on cable, like you seek them out, whatever, that we do romanticize things. The whole experience is
yes
this romanticized idea. So I'm romanticizing the memory of like, no, we all love horror movies and we all cheered and had a great time together. But yeah, people screw it up for us, you know?
And I think one thing that the film missed, unless I'm mistaken, at one point, didn't they draw the church parallel? They made the church parallel?
Yeah.
Okay. Because you go to a theater that was built in the 20s or 30s, And it's this very impressive edifice. It's this magical space. And that's part of movie going that I like. But that has nothing to do with digital versus a celluloid. If you go to modern theaters, and certainly there's some theaters that have tried to do some, the cyberspace set, the wildebeest feast, but by and large, modern theaters are a shoebox,
right,
with a screen the size of a large business envelope, and there's no magic there.
That's showing a movie that is based on four other movies, but now they're going to serve you food during it, because seeing the movie is just part of it, really. It's just this one, it's this thing that's on while somebody serves you food, and you tweet, and it's depressing.
But it makes you feel like grandpa.
Yeah, well, and, you know, some of this documentary did, too, because a lot of the people being interviewed are guys who don't necessarily romanticize the idea of film, and that's part of why there's people holding on to it. You get David Fincher, who's, you know, somebody that we respect, who just has no interest in film anymore, and very early on says something, and again, I should have been writing these things down, but he says a quote that cuts right to who he is as a person, like, oh, now I get to control everything. Now that it's digital, I can control every single thing. And it's like, yeah, if that's what you want, then digital is the format for you.
And I also like all of Robert Rodriguez's comments, because he was on board way early, so he deserves to be in the documentary.
Yeah.
And I think more so than other talking heads, maybe given where he started as a filmmaker, his points are usually very common sense,
right,
and very boilerplate, very nuts and bolts. It's cheaper. It's faster.
Right. It's more flexible. I can do it all.
Yeah,
definitely. And his opinion is just, you know, this is where it's going. Why not be in on the ground floor?
Also, I have to point out one mistake the film made,
courtesy
of my eagle-eyed son, who really knows what he's talking about. At one point, they interview the cinematographer for Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
And is that Michael Chapman?
I will not get the name right.
Okay. Fill in the name of the Taxi Driver. And this was actually one of the parts of the documentary that I liked a lot, where they compared old-fashioned movie making in the following way, that the cinematographer was this magician, and only he knew what it was going to look like, and you had to trust him, and you had to wait 24 hours, and then the dailies would come, and it would be amazing what he had captured, although one of the naysayers says, and sometimes it would come in, and it was shit.
Fincher.
Right.
Yeah.
And to illustrate this, they show a famous shot from Taxi Driver where there is steam, and the cab with this, it's the strangest lens and the strangest color. It's like very saturated, grimy yellow. In super slow motion, the cab drives through the steam. It's a famous shot. According to my son, that was done by the second unit.
Interesting.
The cinematographer of Taxi Driver had nothing to do with that shot. Hey, guys, come on. Come on. Do your research.
Yeah, Fincher is the guy who, again, kind of says, I hate not knowing what it's going to look like. I hate having to wait 24 hours and sometimes having it turn out like, oh, I wish we could have fixed that, you know, or done it better. And so digital allows him to do that, and that's fine. You know, my concern, I don't know, I definitely romanticize film. I'm excited when I find out that a theater is going to be screening something on 35 millimeter, especially if I've never seen a 35-millimeter print of that movie.
And a lot of theaters, I think they did it more in the past, although they're still doing it. The Music Box, having their thumb on the zeitgeist of the community, has started a series now where every month they're going to specifically have screenings from celluloid and advertise this fact and try to get the best prints. So it's like, for all the older people on Southport,
right.
Okay, relax, here's one for you. And I, again, I'm on the fence because one of the things I did like in the documentary was this belief that the cinematographer was this sort of magician and he was doing a magic trick as opposed to digital where you can see it right there.
Right.
Although one of the naysayers says, well, you're not seeing it right there. You're seeing it on a little TV screen. That's not what it's going to look like 80 feet tall in a movie theater, which is a good point. But the thing about the cinematographer's magician reminded me of that scene in David Cronenberg's The Fly, where the idea that gives the Jeff Goldblum, the character, the idea to complete his invention is when aunts and grandparents pinch the kid's cheek, that it's the touch of the flesh that drives them crazy. It's the touch. You don't remember this scene, do you?
No, I don't.
It's not one of the more famous ones, like him breaking some guy's arm off.
That's what I remember.
And throwing up on someone's leg. But
John Getz.
There's something wrong with the machine that he can't teleport it exactly as it is.
Right.
And the idea that there's something in human beings where it's the touch of the flesh that drives you crazy, that ultimately celluloid is a chemical process.
Right.
And it is alchemy.
Right.
To a degree.
This goes to the Christopher Nolan metaphor. And again, Christopher Nolan, there's not that many pro-film voices in the documentary. Christopher Nolan is one, and Wally Pfister is probably the most passionate. Who's Christopher Nolan's DP, and he outwardly says, like, I fucking hate 3D, you know.
And my son had the greatest comment, like, oh, Nolan and Pfister are for film, huh? Nice to be in that position where you've made them so much money, they would let you make a flip book.
Right. But Christopher Nolan likens his opinion of digital is when Chips Ahoy introduced the soft-baked cookie. And he says, so it's supposed to be like this home, like the homemade cookie that you're used to.
Because it's soft.
When you taste it, and yes, it's soft, but then you realize it's just this fake chemical thing. You know, obviously, removing the word chemical, but that's what digital is, that it's this weird approximation of film, but that it's not film. And I thought that was great.
The part of the film that I would really take issue with, and as Patrick said, there's a segment in the middle where I think I turned to my son, as you could tell I watched this with my son because it was great to share that with him, that the middle part almost looked like a commercial for these companies.
Yeah.
I mean, there was footage that was like, why not try the new Aeroflex, even more like film? And then at the end, they gave lip service to something that I really think we need to talk about, and that's preservation.
Yes.
Because, oddly enough, paper has proven to me to be a much better way to keep things that anyone could have dreamed. We're constantly discovering, oh, look, we still have this. And film, too, even though nitrate film was unstable, if you preserve it on safety stock and store it in the right conditions in a vault, right now we know you're good for at least 100 years and maybe more. As several people in the film point out, there have been so many digital formats that now when they store things digitally, they have to archive a reader because they're not sure you're going to be able to read it. And the history of digital isn't old enough.
That's the thing that amazed me, was that all of these advances and, you know, essentially go back to, like, The Phantom Menace in 99. I mean, that's really where it starts. So all this has happened in digital filmmaking has come a long way, and digital projection has come a long way in about 12 years.
But it almost seems like a consequence of commerce that, of course, you want your new big thing to not only be the new big thing, but negate every previous thing. What it reminds me of, I recently found out that an Apple software product will not open all previous versions of that Apple software product. And it was pointed out to me that, say what you want about Microsoft Word, Word will open any Word file that's ever been created. And this is what this whole digital camera thing reminded me of, because when Side-by-Side was first screened, I'm guessing at some festivals, Slate published a lengthy article about the state of film preservation and about just how dicey it is to depend on digital to preserve things. And the operant story, at this point, shut off the podcast, go to Slate, come up with a search term, find the article, because I'm going to paraphrase it badly. We almost lost the original digital files of Toy Story. Forever.
Yeah.
And at that point, people said, well, that son of a bitch sold tens of millions of copies on DVD. Just use one of those. Well, no, that's not it. And what I read, again, I'm paraphrasing, is that someone at Pixar had taken the safety home to do something with it. And if that person hadn't, we would, in essence, have lost the original negative of Toy Story. That's frightening.
Yeah, right. There's such a push for everybody to convert. And Lucas, say what you will, is one of the guys, one of the driving forces behind this whole thing, because he says, we're going to shoot Phantom Menace digitally, we're going to only project Attack the Clones digitally, and so everybody's got to get on board. Avatar comes out, everybody's got to convert to 3D and digital, and now all these theaters are being forced to convert to digital, and some are, you know, possibly going to go out of business. There's a theater here in Chicago that had to do a Kickstarter campaign just to get a digital projector so that they could basically stay open.
And again, this is art meets commerce, because the more I think about this phenomenon, it seems to be a matter of control.
Right.
That the studios are telling theaters, oh, we'll help you to afford one of these projectors, but there's a back-end commitment to it, too,
right,
that you'll have to show our films. So even though half of the documentary says, oh, the technology is in your hands and you can buy it for $150 and anyone can make a film, it's going to be a very, it's going to be a very big bottleneck of what gets in the theaters,
right,
because these digital projectors allow, in effect, the major studios to own the theaters again, just the way they did in the 30s and 40s, which was declared a monopoly,
right,
by the Supreme Court,
right,
in the 50s.
Right. People are so quick to push for this new technology that I don't think anyone has really thought it through. There hasn't been a lot of consideration for how are we archiving stuff, how are we storing stuff. I tried to do a little bit of research. It appears that storing a digital film versus storing, you know, a print of a 35 millimeter costs about 12 times as much to store digital. You know, it's sometimes it's, you're talking about maybe $1,000 for a 35 millimeter print versus $200,000 for a digital file, and they are unstable, and they can, one guy says, you got to take it out every once in a while and run the hard drive.
I love that guy.
And if you don't, it sticks.
He
but if
makes,
you do it too much, it craps out.
And he did the noise.
Yeah.
He imitated the noise,
right,
of the stuck hard drive.
Right.
At the end of the
and
documentary,
now you've lost your film.
At the end of the documentary, I thought one of the ironies that it brought to my mind is, could the future be we record the film digitally, we edit the film digitally, we project the film digitally, and then we preserve it on celluloid.
Maybe.
That celluloid will be the archival medium. That
it's,
would be so
but see,
wild.
I think it's all being run by people who just have no, who just feel that that is archaic. That anything to do with, so why would we bother with this celluloid?
But in a way, it's
they're trying to convince you that, like, oh, you have to deliver the reels, and it's, oh, it's such a hassle. Here, you could just beam it straight in. But that doesn't work all the time, too.
Because, again, this is art meets commerce, and the thing that lit up on the business side is shipping is really expensive because prints are big and heavy. It's expensive,
right,
to, a film opens on 3,000 screens. That is physically manufacturing 3,000 copies of that print and shipping them in these big cans, that it's definitely the businessman who's making that assertion. And there's a short sightedness there that reminds me of Hollywood when sound came in. They said, at this point I shed a tear, people don't want to watch silent movies anymore, and in some cases they dump them into the sea.
And that's a little bit where we're at now. I mean, maybe not that drastic, but I think people are saying people don't care about celluloid. Now it's digital, and it's very short-sighted.
And in the 40s, there was this belief that once the film had had its first and second run, it was over. And then suddenly television says, oh, no, we can sell them again. And then later the video boom shows people just what an asset you have. But again, we brought this up on the podcast too, and I wanted to bring it up again. If every theater winds up with a digital projector and nothing else, what will be the range of older films,
right,
that we're allowed to see in a movie theater?
Right.
The documentary, without ever saying this, again, I'm inferring, I'm reading between the lines, seems to suggest that older films will be the stuff of home and Netflix and your phone. And clearly, maybe that's the way the studio wants it, because they want new product in the theaters. But oddly enough, in the last year, I've seen more and more older films being projected, these Fathom events, these TCM screenings, at many theaters in our area, they're discovering that these midnight shows really pack them in, and it's all older films.
Yeah.
Although, did you hear what the next one is at the Tivoli?
Yes.
Yes. Very odd choice. I wonder who made that decision.
There's a theater near us that's going to do a midnight show of Midnight in Paris, because it's the title.
It's midnight. But up until now, it's been Back to the Future, Jaws, Big Lebowski, Raiders of the Lost Ark. What I keep predicting will be the 15.
Blues Brothers.
We'll make 4K digital scans of 15 older films.
Right. And unless they do that, and that's an expensive process, I'm sure. Unless they do that, so now we're out of luck on every other older movie now, right? If everybody converts to digital.
I had this hope, and again, this is not seeing it in a movie theater, so that's a very, very different thing, that I can see in my lifetime a service like Netflix offering every movie that exists, that will be the selection.
Yeah, but it's not the same, like you said.
It's not the same as in a movie theater either, although you can see these up-and-coming companies like Tug partnering with Netflix and seeing if there's money to be made.
Maybe.
The Repertory Theater by our house is still in business, although recently someone told me it's owned by a company that's so rich, they see it as a boutique business that's allowed to lose money every year.
Do you think that we might see more of those start to pop up? If everything converts to digital, do you think that somebody will realize, okay, maybe there's a demand for 35mm screenings, and I would imagine that the prints would be pretty easy to come by if there's no demand for those really in the marketplace.
This is a complicated question. I see 35 going away.
Yeah. See, that's what bums me out, because I'm fine with digital. And if a movie was shot digitally or projected digitally, the reason that I want to go see a movie, a 35mm print of a movie, is because that's how it was made. Right. I don't care about seeing a 35mm print of Social Network. That means nothing to me. But if a movie was shot in 35, that's how I want to see it.
It's the native format. I see 35mm going away completely. I think that's in the cards. I think there's no way you're going to stop that.
Well, they stopped making cameras. They say that in the documentary. Like last year, or do they say that in the documentary, or did I read that? No, they say it in the documentary. They have stopped, every major camera manufacturer has stopped production on 35mm cameras.
Which then the documentary is very clever to say, and of course that means that will stop the innovation.
Right.
In 35mm cameras.
But more than one person says 35 has gone as far as it's going to go.
Which I think that's one of the first things in the documentary, that Lucas makes that point. If you are on board for 35mm, you are at the end of the road for that show.
Right.
Why not jump on board this, which is in its beginnings and stuff like that?
There's truth to that.
I think 35mm is going to go, and it's going to go sooner rather than later. On that note, though, recently you saw a 70mm print of The Master at the Music Box Theater, and one, how did it look?
It was better than any 3D or IMAX or any of these gimmicky formats that movies play in now. It was unreal.
Ebert, one year at his wonderful film festival, showed 2001, A Space Odyssey, in 70mm.
Yeah.
And it was one of the most awe-inspiring things. It was as if you had never seen the movie.
And I've only seen a handful of 70mm in recent years. One of the old movie theaters by our house used to do 70mm, but I was at an age where I probably couldn't have told the difference. So every time I go see one now, which is rarely because there's really only one theater that has the equipment now.
Which was the second point I wanted to make. You had to see that at the Music Box.
Right.
And they kept saying this the whole week leading up to it. The Music Box in Chicago is the only theater probably in the Midwest that's still equipped to show 70mm.
And they had to go through a whole conversion process. It took them the whole week to switch everything over. So I expect it to be, okay, maybe it'll be a little different. I remember going to see Vertigo a couple years in 70mm at the Music Box and not expecting it to be what it was and just being like, holy shit, that really is different. And again, even with The Master, like, okay, but is it really going to be that different? It is totally different.
I love
It's amazing.
I love what I heard the manager of the music box set before the screening. The only way you won't see a difference is if you're not facing the screen.
Yeah.
That being said, I think the only hope for older films being in real theaters, regardless of the format, although I think it will be digital, is there's this thing called the baby boom. And we have nothing but nostalgia for the things of our youth. And we're not going anywhere. We don't plan on dying anytime soon. And I think that might be something that spurs this on. But the other problem is, as you get older, I think you tend to go out less and less.
Sure.
Plus, you know, the dinner special's at 4, so you're going to want to
get
that.
Happen?
You don't want to be a spendthrift.
But then there's somebody like me who's sort of trapped between these two generations.
Which I don't, I'm not jealous of the fact that you are. And you are.
And when the baby boomers are gone, and the world is in the hands of the generation younger than me, it's all gone. And so somebody like me, who has nostalgia for something that I wasn't even necessarily a part of, you know, I just have to watch it taken away because these people don't care. They hold nothing dear.
So we're gonna flash forward a couple decades. Now I'm gone. Patrick's an old man. He's talking to his son. You see, there used to be this place, this beautiful place that made me so happy. Dad, are you off your meds? You know what the doctor said about staying on your meds, but just it was real. I swear it was real, Charlie boy.
And that place, dry land.
Suddenly, we're plunged back into the Water World podcast.
It's it bums me out. And again, I don't mind, you know, that the business right now seems to sort of be straddling the two, although it's definitely leaning one way.
That's the apparent metaphor. And oddly enough, some of you know, a couple weeks ago, we hosted a screening of Die Hard. That was just one of the best things. And if anything, this argument made the whole thing sweeter because you had to make a choice between digital and celluloid.
Yeah.
And you went with celluloid. And about 7 minutes in, the film broke.
Yeah.
And everyone, is it going to be, remember?
Oh,
is it going to be an evening of this?
Listen, at every real change, I tensed up. Every time I saw the little dot in the corner, is it going to break? Is this the one that does it?
And after that first little thing,
which the theater fixed right away,
there wasn't a problem. It looked, especially the last 40 minutes, it looked beautiful.
Yeah.
And to me, this whole argument that we're talking about made that screening sweeter because I sat there and I said, this is a great glass of wine and they ain't making this wine anymore.
Yeah, right. I had never seen a 35mm print of Die Hard, and now I have, you know, and that means something to me. And I know that doesn't mean something to everyone. Again, the documentary towards the end sort of does talk about this younger generation of people who just aren't precious about these kinds of things and who are willing to watch a movie on a cell phone. And you have a few talking heads who say, like, no, that's not how you see a movie. You see it in a theater on a giant screen. But you even have cinematographers and people who say, like, no, yeah, sometimes I'll watch a movie, you know, on my computer or whatever. And that's what it is now. I don't know. Again, there's no way to talk about this without romanticizing it, because that's what we do. That's why we are on a film podcast. That's why we love movies, because we've turned them into this thing in our minds. But
because we're searching for romance?
Perhaps. But it's supposed to be something special. It's not just this thing that you do to kill time on a train.
It's not bubblegum for the eyes.
Right.
You had mentioned that there's films that you've seen, and there's films that you've seen on video, and there's films that you've seen in a theater. And I know there was a period of time, especially in my film study class, where some of my kids who were really into it had seen it, but never seen it in a theater. And that makes me feel old, because I predate video.
Yeah.
I predate home video. So until my junior year, time for a 1 minute story?
Yeah.
I'm a sophomore in high school. A friend of mine, hi Kevin, his father buys one of the first consumer grade VHS players. And instead of going to the turnabout dance, we go to his house with our girlfriends and we watch The Godfather. And I'm a sophomore, so what, I'm 16?
Sure.
And I'm sitting there. wait, you can watch this whenever you want? And you can run stuff back?
Right.
And there's no commercials, and they didn't edit the dirty or violent parts out? It was like magic.
Yeah.
But every single one of my film-going experiences up to then were in a theater. So that's very much why it's special to me.
And it is different, because again, to go back to Die Hard, and I think I said this when we talked about Die Hard on this podcast, I don't remember what show it was, after the screening, I had pointed out that there were things that I noticed in that screening that I had never seen before, and I absolutely attribute that to the fact that it was on film, and it was just bigger, if nothing else. It was huge, and I was able to see things that I just never noticed on video. Maybe that's because it commanded my attention more than it ever had before. I don't know, but it's a different experience, and I have almost a checklist in my head where if I see a 35mm print of something, I can say, like, okay, check, good. I've got that one. And if I see it again, great. But if not, I know that I saw it.
That it's not real until you've seen it in the theater.
Right.
Up until then, it's simulacra.
Right.
I think I dreamt that movie.
And I'm at the point now where even, you know, they did a 4K scan of Jaws recently, and you saw it, and you said it was incredible, and it's beautiful. But if I had a choice between a 4K scan and a 35mm print, I would go see the 35mm, even though it's going to look worse.
One thing I've learned, I've watched the bonus features on the Blu-ray. I haven't watched the feature yet, because, again, I recently saw the 4K scan. The famous scene where Quint gives the famous USS Indianapolis speech, they fixed it in the new one, because apparently before, some of the cutaways out the window, the time of night didn't match. Some of them were lighter than others. And I would argue, I've seen that film a bunch of times. What he's saying is so compelling,
right.
I never noticed.
Right.
But apparently they fixed it.
And I just heard that conversation. I think the Slash Filmcast recently did a show on Jaws. And it was very depressing, because about half the people on the show were like, yeah, Jaws is fine, but... And I don't know how you get to a point where Jaws is good, but... And one of their things was, the shark looks kind of fake at times. And one of the guys on the show, who used to write for Ain't It Cool under the name Quint, is such a big fan of Jaws that obviously he was going under the name, made the same point, that if you are noticing that the shark looks fake, the movie isn't working for you. Like, something's wrong. If that's what you're picking up on, the shark looks kind of fake.
Speaking of seeing things in a theater, I can still remember seeing Jaws in a theater.
I never have.
Because I was young enough where I shouldn't have been seeing Jaws in a
yeah,
theater.
Right, all right.
Because I had never seen an audience that scared in my life.
Sure.
I mean, it was something. And then I kind of filed it away for about 2 decades. And I don't think I saw it again. And I knew how good it was, but it was just something in the background. And it's only been in, like, the last 5 or 6 years that it's sort of bubbled up. And it's like, oh, yeah, that's one of the greatest films ever made. It does...
There's a short list of perfect movies.
Yeah, and that certainly is.
Absolutely.
And a couple summers ago, we rented an inflatable screen.
Yeah.
And we showed it in my backyard.
A double feature of Creature from the Black Lagoon and Jaws.
You got to theme those things. And it's wonderful. In fact, your wife has a photograph of the screen. And even in the photograph, the image looks good.
Yeah.
Even though it's not on celluloid. It was in my backyard.
There's in a column that I wrote recently, I don't remember what it was, I talked about there's all these movies that we grew up, that I, you know, specifically grew up with, where there's an image or two that stand out in your mind. The rest of the movie kind of melts away, but it's this one little thing that scars you. It's usually like a PG movie that's a little too scary. It was Dragon Slayer, because I had forgotten every aspect of Dragon Slayer except a girl getting her foot bit off in this PG movie produced by Disney.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Or Toad's face melting in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
That had a big effect on you.
And in Jaws, you know, growing up, I saw it, but there were years, you know, where I didn't, and I couldn't remember anything about it except for the blood coming out of Quint's mouth. And I remembered it so differently. I remembered it as this geyser coming out of his mouth, and then I see it, and, oh, that's a little different, but I was traumatized by that.
Two quick things. You mentioned that some people said the shark looked fake.
Yes.
I used to get this from kids in my class all the time, that something would play out on the screen. Oh, that looks so stupid. That looks so fake. And my question was, when have you ever seen that for real? What are you comparing it to? In most cases, you're comparing it to another fiction. So you've spent time with sharks? It's very strange to me when people accuse things of being fakey.
Well, especially in a movie where the whole thing is a construct, and that's one of the things that James Cameron tries to kind of say, albeit in his dickish way. Keanu Reeves kind of says, like, oh, but everything is like this artificial construct when you're just shooting in front of a green screen and it's all done on a computer. And he says, well, you've been on a film set. When has it ever been real? You know, there's only one wall, or there's this, or there's, you know, it's a set. It's all a fake construct. And I just don't understand how you go to a movie, which you know is
right,
real people playing pretend for your entertainment.
It's because
and
for
then
so
whine
many,
that, like, oh, that shark looks fake.
It's because for so many decades, the art of Hollywood was using the artifice to conceal the artifice. The intention of most Hollywood narrative films is to convince you that what you're watching is real.
Right.
And we don't have enough films that play with that, because by and large, people don't like that. It's strange that you say that one Cameron quote, because looking back at the film, all I remember James Cameron saying was that all of life springs from his imagination. At one point, doesn't he say that?
Does he?
It's when they show that chick flying on that big bird, suddenly I feel like I'm watching the Flintstones.
Right. I don't know. Is fidelity to reality, is that your criteria for if something is good or not? Because look at Avatar, where it's not only is it not real, it's not even tangible. It's drawings. It's cartoons. And it may look great, but it's not. At least Jaws was a real thing that they filmed that light reacted to.
Terry Gilliam has a famous comment about doing physical effects versus digital effects. That when you're doing digital effects, it's the work of one person and how it should look. But if you actually construct it, it's light bouncing off this thing the way it does in nature. And there's hundreds of intangibles.
Right.
So that's the reason you can tell. Because you can't be tricked by one mind. You can only be tricked by the reality of real light.
And, I mean, ultimately, that's where I come down on this whole debate. I wish there was room for both. I wish there was room for practical and digital. I wish there was room for film and digital. And so I'm sad to see this thing that I love being pushed out, which is what's happening.
That's such a sad note to end
on. Can you happy it up?
So now we're going to sing a song. No, all kidding aside. Folks, if you're listening to this.
Which I assume you are.
If you've gotten this far, congratulations. Please leave comments under this one.
Yeah.
About how you feel. I mean, if it truly is you're on this side or whatever, we'd really like to read in the comment section where you guys fall, especially those of you who weigh in a lot. I'm curious to hear what you think.
Yeah, great. Awesome. Thank you guys for listening. Leave comments, and you can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. See you next time.
It's magic. I'm on celluloid.